scour mental homes for young women who were quite vulnerable. One time he had, I think, five women in his basement. When one woman died, he ended up feeding the surviving women the remains of her body.
Oof.
They then locked her in the outhouse, so that would have been about 1980, and she wasn't released until 2005. He had six teenage girls kidnapped and held in various properties that he owned around Belgium. His mother had even gone to the police and said he's holding girls captive in his basement, and the police just ignored him. So he built his dungeon, and he just hired contractors and just brought them in and said, I want somewhere to store my things. But they didn't realise that the things that he was storing were humans.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 9. Very excited about this installment of the program. This is a strange episode in a way because it came from just sort of shooting the breeze on a previous edition of the show. When I was talking to Marie Jones and Larry Flaxman, I kind of said offhandedly how much I'd love to learn more about cases where people are held captive. And specifically like that story in Cleveland that made huge news over the last couple of years. And lo and behold, you know, I finished that episode and start looking around on the internet and kind of dawns on me. I'm like, somebody has to have written a book on this. And then thankfully I find Captive Humans, which was written by David Phoebe. And you can find out more about it at captivehumans.com. And immediately I was like, this is too serendipitous not to do a show about, and I am really fascinated by the topic, so I think it's perfect BOA audio material. As I said, you can find out more about it at captivehumans.com. The book is Captive Humans, chronicles 28 cases of people who are held captive, and I kind of struggled with the way to describe this, and we'll get into this as we talk a little bit, but they're kidnapped, but in some cases they aren't kidnapped. In some cases it's a completely different scenario. So it's hard. They're all very unique situations. What they all have in common is that these people are held against their will for sometimes unimaginable lengths of time and suffer from unimaginable horrors during these ordeals. So it's going to be a creepy show, it's going to be an enlightening show, and I think it's really going to be a fascinating show as well. David, welcome to BOA Audio. Thank you so much for coming on the program.
G'day, Tim. Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here, and I'm happy to tell your audience a bit about the stories of people held captive across the world.
It's some amazing stuff. It really is. And I actually went all this time introducing the program and didn't even mention. David is coming to us all the way from Australia, where it is 11 at night for him, and right now it's 9 a.m. for me. So for the folks who are wondering why we didn't do this one live, it's because I don't know if I could do a live show at 9 a.m. It's it's a bit crazy. So
it's also the middle of winter here for us as well, so it's I've got a chest infection, so you have to forgive me from that. That happens in winter, so.
No worries. Duly noted. We'll be perfectly fine. Don't worry about that. And it's just really cool to be coming at you from all the way across the world here, putting together this conversation. So, David, tell us a little bit about, you know, who is David Phoebe and what led you to writing this book?
Okay. I started writing my first articles for newspapers when I was about 17 for my local newspaper, and then did some writing courses and ended up writing for other newspapers, and was a health writer for a while with an Australian magazine, and did some writing for television as I continued studying. And then I swapped over and started studying criminal justice, and that's where I currently work in criminal justice. And I wanted to, one day I thought, I want to keep, you know, I finally want to actually write a book. So, and I had a look, I was interested in people who'd been held captive, but I couldn't find a book that summed it up.
Sound like me now.
Well, the cases have been all over the place for me, like, and some of them didn't have the conclusion. I couldn't find what happened or know, there was big parts missing.
Right.
So what I did is when I was, I remember the case from when I was about, probably about 17 as well, and it was about David Bisson, who was held captive by his mother in France for about 8 years, and I read the newspaper article about that, and after how he had escaped after being locked in the cupboard. And that sort of stayed with me. And then when the Fritzl case broke, which everyone would know about, or most people would, I became intrigued with that and sort of obsessive over the Fritzl case. And I started writing a blog about the lesser-known cases, because I knew there were ones out there like David Bisson, that didn't get any mention. But I didn't sort of... I for some reason, I made it sort of try to do a bit comedic, and it didn't work, and it just stayed there for a long time. I only did a few cases before it petered off, as blogs often do.
Yeah.
And then, it got a total of 71 hits when I went back a few years later when I decided to start writing captive humans. I went, okay, we can do, have to do this in a completely different way.
Right, right.
So it was basically I couldn't find a book that, sort of put the cases the way I was looking to see them, but also I wanted to make sure that when I wrote the book had, that was short. I wanted to be, make sure each chapter was short, but you got the whole story from start to finish.
Right.
You had a narrative that, that went through it, and it was easily digestible. And I wanted it to be so that you could read a chapter on your way to work, or your way to the shops, or wherever you go, or to, you're catching a train.
Right.
And by the time you finish reading it, you'd understand the story. And if you wanted to go further and find out about a particular case, you could go and research that story, but you knew the overall story. So that's how it came together.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good point, because it's fantastically well put together. I got to give you kudos here, because the way you nailed it there, because the way I read it, you know, I would sit and I would pop in a couple cases, you know, I do about three or four. You can only, in a way, it's kind of, you need to read it that way. I think you probably need to put it together that way, in a sense, you know, you can't over, this is not an all-in-one sitting type book. It's kind of like a nice leisurely kind of, you know, as sort of paradoxical as it sounds, folks, I'm going to recommend this as like a beach book, because this is perfect, you know, I know it's winter where you are, David, but here it's summertime, and I think it's a, for BOA audio readers, it's the kind of perfect companion if you're going on a trip, because, you know, you might be able to steal away 20 minutes, 30 minutes here and there, and this book, you can just, like I said, pop in a couple cases, and they're all really, really compelling stuff. It's just absolutely compelling stuff.
Surprisingly enough, you know, when you read the cases, you'll realize that many of them start to link in with each other, and they have, you know, you think, oh, that's an isolated case, but years later down the track, there's a connection to another case. So we'll cover that, I'm sure.
Absolutely, yeah. And as I said when we started out the program, it's kind of interesting because I did struggle in a way with how to describe the scenario, if you will, because one interesting aspect that emerges from the book is that there's this variety of motivations for these cases. Well, the one that I think everybody goes to immediately because it's titillating, of course, is that's the sex element, that these people are being held captive for sex. But you have to get beyond that, because then there's all kinds of other reasons why these things are happening in the different cases. One guy really wants to father like 10 children. So he has this elaborate scheme. We'll get into that case in a little bit. But what really heartbreaking, that happens again and again is these cases of, parental abuse, where parents just, completely neglect the child, but just keep them captive, lock them away in a room or in the basement or in a shed for just an amazing length of time. And it's, you know, this, in a lot of those cases, there's not some sex element there. It's like almost, like a perverse shame or something. And I'm sure, as I said, we're going to get into cases like that as well. And then there's sort of a money motivation in some of these instances, you know, where people are being held captive and whoever's holding them captive is reaping the rewards of, their work or their, social security or something like that. So I guess before we dive into the specific cases, talk a little bit about how, this is sort of a wide-ranging phenomenon. It's not, these aren't sex slaves, you know, these aren't people that are just captive to be used for the pleasure of the captor. These are all kinds of reasons why these things happen.
Yeah, so some of them are, sex slaves. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that is the one that most people will focus on. And there's a, something that, turned up was a lot of people with disability are held, captive and abused for many years, either by their family members or by people wanting to take advantage of them. And also, a lot of it is, of course, control and domination, and that the people who have been the perpetrators have, you know, often have terrible backgrounds themselves.
Mm.
And so it sort of it doesn't seem to happen in isolation. It tends to be sort of often a lot of forewarning or a lot of clues that are missed along the way about when... it's eventually discovered that people have been held captive. And there's also the unique element of self-captivity. So where there's two particular cases that Natasha Ryan and Tanya Cash have, it appears they weren't technically held captive, but or may have been held captive. It's you know, some of that's up for debate about what occurred. So, you know, it's up to the reader, I guess, to make their opinion on that.
Right. I forgot about that whole element too. That yeah, there are cases in the book where you're really left puzzled as to what exactly happened in this instance. And the Natasha Ryan one is definitely definitely the key case in that regard. Now, before the interview, I sent you, I cherry picked my quote unquote favorite. Cases from the book,
sure.
Or the ones that particularly stood out to me. As we said, there's 28 cases in there, folks, ranging across 11 countries, which I think is really fascinating, and we'll explore as we go on, because each country sort of has its own cultural reaction to this, which is really, really, really fascinating, because we've seen it unfold here in America, and even it's changed here,
yeah.
Here in America in a way, because I noticed something as I was going over the notes again before the show, I want to make sure I bring up. But let's jump into the cherry-picked cases here. And I started out with the one that really originally sort of... I've always been interested in this, but kind of reinserted the bee in my bonnet on the captive humans phenomenon. And that was... I saw an episode... I think there's a show about captive humans now. I'm pretty sure there is. Because I saw a show...
Okay.
I think it's just called Kidnapped, so it's probably...
Okay.
Variety of things. I think it's on Netflix, but if you Google Colleen Stan, you'll be able to find it because she was like, I think, on the premiere episode, or she was, her case was the premiere episode. And I was just completely fascinated by this. There's so many weird elements to this case and horrifying elements. You've got sort of a weird Bonnie and Clyde accomplice situation with the wife of the kidnapper.
Yeah.
You've got the mind control elements that are there. You've got something that completely is mind-blowing on these cases of a captive human where she ends up going back to visit her family while under the auspices, I guess you could say, of the kidnapper. So there's a lot going on in this case that is really, really unique and interesting and strange and unsettling. So share the Colleen Stan story with the folks here listening. You know, thumbnail it. You don't have to give us the full Monty, if you will, but give us the sort of the beginning, middle, and end, if you will.
Okay, so Colleen Stan, she was released in or escaped in Red Bluff in California in 1984. Colleen had been traveling to see a friend for her birthday when she decided to hitchhike, and she tried a few people to hitchhike with, then eventually came across a couple in a car, Cameron Hooker and his wife. She thought because they had a baby that they would be safe to go with. Though when she went to the bathroom along the way, she said something told her to run, but she just ignored it. And during the kidnap, they took her to an isolated spot and put a something over her head called a head box, which was basically a wooden box padded, and then another wooden box, and that was locked so that she couldn't scream. And this would become a major theme in her her kidnapping is all related to boxers, because once he was heavily into sadomasochism.
Yeah.
But his wife Janice was getting tired of it and needed a break. They had children. So part of the agreement was the couple together would kidnap another young woman, Janice, sort of spite.
So essentially what you're saying, leading into the story, is that he's into bondage and that kind of stuff. And so and the wife can't take it anymore. And so they're like, she agrees to, I guess, get him a new toy, if you will, as sick as that is. That's what
correct.
It is in this sick relationship. She's tired of being the victim of, the outlet for his bondage fantasies. So she's like, well, just instead of leaving the guy and taking the kid, she agrees to kidnap a young woman, and go along with this crazy scheme, which is bizarre in and of itself. But I guess, that was the 70s, folks.
Yeah, and she also became like a domestic servant as well. So not only a sex slave, but someone who's helping around the house and also looking after their children. When Colleen is first kidnapped, she's placed in a box and she's confined for 4 months. And this is a part of Cameron Hooker's idea of isolating the victim to make sure that they don't have any contact with anyone else, and makes them, the victim very dependent on their captor. And this starts becoming quite common to other cases. Fritzl did the same. He would chain his Elizabeth up, and the isolation, but also the restraint as well. But then he also used another technique, and which was called the company. And he told her that there was an overreaching company across the United States that kidnapped other young women and held them captive. And they all knew about her. And this could be police officers or just local people in the street. So anywhere if she saw anyone, it'd be instant fear, and believed that if she disobeyed him in any way, because they were always watching, that her family would be killed. So he tried to test how much he could control her by letting her return home for 24 hours and telling her that the company was looking out for him and making sure that she didn't do anything wrong. So then 24 hours later, he contacts her and comes and picks her up and takes her back home, but feeling anxious that he may have given himself away, he then builds another box, and which is inside a larger box, and he hides them under the family bed, the marital bed, for 3 years. And Colleen lives under the bed, and she's under there so long, even the children, who are starting to grow up now, don't even recognize that she's in the house.
Let me stop you there, just to drive the point home to folks. Like, she's locked in a box. How often was she even let out of the box to go to the bathroom or to clean her up or anything? I'm talking 3 years, folks. I don't know if I could do, like, I don't know if I could do 3 hours in a box like that. 3 years. That's amazing.
Well, she was only let out of the box when his wife wasn't home, because his wife had sort of almost like turned a blind eye to her by then. He'd started returning to abusing his wife, and he seemed someone who was masochistic by nature and didn't wish to make ever a complaint against her husband. It wasn't until she went to a church and then confessed to a priest about what was going on, where she told them to escape. She told Janice to escape from her husband, which she didn't do, and later the police were alerted. Then Colleen was told by Janice that the company didn't exist. When Colleen found out the company didn't exist, the world crumbled for Cameron, because he lost that control. And the next day she went to a bus shelter and made her way home, but without telling the police. And the police weren't told for another 3 months, because Colleen was still in contact with her kidnapper. She still had a strange relationship happening, and it would be quite a while before, by the time 3 months came, a lot of the evidence had been destroyed, but there was enough to still charge Cameron Hooker with the crime.
Right, right. What became of Janice following the case? Because I know he went to jail, but what didn't she pretty much kind of get away?
Yeah, Janice didn't really have much of a didn't. She was never punished for participating in any of the crimes, and she actually became when returned to her maiden name and believed to work as a like a social worker in California still. So it's quite a different lifestyle from the one that she had.
Yeah, that's amazing to think that she was certainly complicit. I mean, I know she was also kind of a victim of this guy, but at the same time, she was also pretty complicit in the whole thing, and it's like she just kind of, nothing ever really happens to her. That's spooky.
No, it's also interesting that there does seem to be a fair amount of women who are involved in crimes, these crimes. It's often perceived that it tend to be just a male holding a female in a dungeon and that's how it turns out. But there often females have very active roles, whether they're their husbands, with their husbands or with, they're the instigators themselves.
Right. Exactly. That's a key point. Okay, that's the Colleen Stan case. We're going to kind of jump, keep going here so I don't,
Sure.
So we don't focus. Because we could, like you said about each chapter, I mean, you could do a whole show on each one of these cases. That's how crazy they are. So we need to make sure people get a wide sampling of all this stuff. Now, another one in the book that really stood out to me was Gary Heidnik. He's the guy I alluded to earlier who, his obsession was to father like 10 children. He'd already fathered other children, but they kept getting taken away from him. And so he had to, kidnap women and try and get them pregnant to have a baby, have many babies, really. It's quite the twisted, plan, if you will. But I thought was interesting too is the key part that stood out to me is, you see it from time to time in these cases. Once everything goes down and they capture the kidnapper, they can't handle it and they kill themselves, like the dude in Cleveland, Ariel Castro, another guy later in the book, Wolfgang Proklopil. He kills himself like immediately after the victim escapes.
Sure.
And this guy, when they arrest him, he keeps trying to kill himself. So it's like, the weakness of these people once they lose control is remarkable.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, there are a number of suicides of the captors straight after they've been arrested or when things are getting close. Also, Paul Hose with the Tanya Cash case, he attempted suicide as well. And also, one of the first stories I started with was Susan Jeannie Wiley, which is an interesting case if anyone wants to look it up, that a girl held captive by her parents in her bedroom for 12 years. In Acadia, and he committed suicide. The father, who held a captive, committed suicide on the day of the court case for the other remaining son to find. Gary Heinick, his mother originally committed suicide on Mother's Day as a comment to the boys for not feeling loved enough.
Oh my God!
Gary ended up running a church which made him a lot of money, quite rich as well. And his congregation was made up of people who weren't really accepted at other churches, people with mental disabilities or drug problems or who just didn't fit in with normal society, wouldn't be accepted at normal churches. So he'd scour mental homes for young women who were quite vulnerable. And over time, one time he had five women in his basement. He'd mainly be torturing these ladies and also by keeping them in a pit and often putting them in a pit with water where they'd stay for hours and using electric cables to shock them. He'd be feeding them dog food, and when one woman died, he ended up feeding the surviving women the remains of her body.
Oof.
And this is in Philadelphia, so this is one of the most impoverished parts of the United States. And also one of the early cases of people being held captive, especially on such a large scale.
Mm.
An interesting point, too, is that he got sentenced to death, and when he was being put to death, activists who generally turn up to executions were not as, you know, they weren't noticeably absent from his particular one. So even those who, you know, wanted the death penalty abolished would didn't even bother turning up.
Yeah, that's how. Yeah, that's how cut and dry the evilness of this dude was. That's scary that he had five people in the basement. That's just, and then like you say, you know, it's like a punchline almost. I know you think it's, well, I know you say it's impoverished Philadelphia, but it's still, it's like a major American city. And this dude's got these five girls in his basement. Again, another parallel to the Ariel Castro case, you know, where it's like, this was just going on in some neighborhood somewhere that no one, you know, people didn't seem to notice or care. It's scary.
Yeah, and people could disappear quite easily, and they didn't make much of a mention about it. It seemed to just be something that happened all the time, and people come and go from each other's life in a, you know, very transient way. And, yeah, it seems quite sad that, you know, people can go missing for sometimes weeks or months or years, and people aren't even aware of their disappearance.
Yeah, it's pretty spooky, but most of the people who are victims, that seems to be one recurring theme, that they're not necessarily transients, but certainly people that could easily disappear and not raise a fuss. What I thought was interesting, I kind of alluded to this earlier, I noticed this, I was going over the notes again tonight, or today, before I sat down to talk to you, and one thing that stood out to me in a horrifying way is, you look at the difference how they handled these girls in Cleveland, how the fallout was there this last couple of years. This Heidnik case, I believe, was in the 80s, and might have been the 90s. I don't know off the top of my head. But
87,
okay.
87, yeah, 87.
Well, the point you make in the book is that these poor girls who escape, they had a rough time assimilating back into normal society, and they were known as the Heidnik girls, and people would call out Alpo to them because that's what this sicko fed them in the basement. It's like, what's wrong with what? That's so heartbreaking that people they're being teased on the streets for being victims of this lunatic. It's sad.
Yeah, Alpo is a dog food. I didn't know what that was when I was writing. Whereas they, the particularly, was, you know, very similar in style. When they released, these girls sort of just got mostly, you know, overlooked by society. They sort of fell back into society almost where they'd left off. Whereas Cleveland was quite different, and I think it's probably going to point more to some of the future of what's coming, is the media sensation that surrounded that case was quite amazing. And you're seeing people who you don't necessarily see on American television, and the reaction over the internet, which of course wasn't going to happen in 1987, that seems to be growing the interest in the cases, or sensationalism around the cases as what has been growing. You look at how it became, particularly the Castro case, it became, there was a song made out of the interview of the fellow who rescued them. You know, and that same song, the same style of song, was used in a Netflix comedy series called The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, which a series I quite liked. But it was about women who'd been held captive in a bunker and are now living in a world 15 years later.
Right,
not
right.
Based on reality in any particular way. But it's just amazing how that particular story sort of has really permeated the culture and has really created a very unique kind of byproduct of the whole captivity case.
Yeah, it's amazing. You raise a good point. It's kind of, it's funny in a weird way that, you know, your book came out right about as this case broke, right? I mean, obviously you had no idea.
Correct.
So yeah, because it's not in the book. Because the book came out when it all went down. So you had fortuitous timing, I guess is the point I'm trying to make. Because this is really kind of a hot phenomenon in a sad way, but still.
The book was just like finished that morning. Like some small details were made. And I was like, okay, now this can go to print. And then it was just like by lunchtime I was listening to the radio. And I was like, what? Did I hear that? And then I had to, question people in the room, like, what happened? Did you just hear that? And then I was like, this is amazing. This is happening right now. And I couldn't believe it. It was astounding. So.
Yeah, that's a weird, we talk about this on the show sometimes, you know, people who are, I know this is not paranormal, but it's like almost like the universe was winking at you, David, where it was like, oh yeah, nice job on the book. Here's God's way of letting you know he's got an eye on your work. You know, it's creepy, in a fun way. Okay, so that's Gary Heidnik. The next case that stood out to me, for unique reasons is Mark Dutroux. And this is in Belgium. And what was interesting here, as you point out, there was a huge political mess, a fallout, following his crimes and everything, because he essentially kind of skated by the system and managed to keep up his crimes without anyone picking up on it, even though they should have. And in turn, people were very upset about how it all unfolded. I guess just talk a little bit about the sort of political fallout that arose following the revelations of what Mark Dutroux was up to and what he was up to. Fill people in on that.
So Mark Dutroux had been in prison already for raping five young girls, all with his wife, then Michelle Martin. He only had to spend a few years in prison, and then he was back out, and he was committing crimes again. So he had six young girls, teenage girls, kidnapped and held in various properties that he owned around Belgium. The police were alerted that there was something wrong with Mark Dutroux, but they didn't really follow up on it enough. The police officers went to one of his apartments once, and an electrician or a locksmith said he could hear young girls crying, and that he was dismissed and said, "Oh, it's kids out on the streets," by the police officers. And when this case broke that four girls had died and two had just been released. They were released very publicly, taken home and reintroduced to their family in front of the media. Mm-hmm. Caused such a storm in Belgium that it almost overthrew the government. There was a march on the streets called the White March, and where firefighters would go and hose down the Capitol building to as a signifier of washing away corruption while he was being held. Uh-huh. He started to tell stories of that he wasn't alone in his crime. He certainly wasn't, because there was many other people who were involved in kidnapping. One of them died along the way, one of his victims too. But he said there was a great pedophile network working in Belgium that went through the police, went through parliament, went through high-level officials. And this really stirred up controversy in Belgium, and it became debatable whether he was telling the truth. By the time he got to court and his court case was done, which was 8 years later, they said there was no evidence of a pedophile network, but because he said he'd supplied so many officials and the police are so inadequate at, you know, catching him. You know, there's still doubt in Belgium's mind whether he was actually leading on to something, telling the truth.
Right, right.
So it's that one's up to people to figure out for themselves what they believe in that case.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. It's like fuel for the conspiracy theorists that, because there are the theories that sort of thing goes on here in America. So it's like, if it's not true, I'm sure that's kind of where he heard the whole idea. Or it's sort of like an urban legend in general, or maybe it's true. Who knows? That there's this sort of pedophilia ring amongst the higher
ups. Yeah, and it's the fear, like, how was he able to get away with doing it for so long? His mother had even gone to the police and said she wrote a letter to the police and said he's holding girls captive in his basement, and the police just ignored him. And the police also had videotapes of the girls being abused, and they didn't watch them. They said they didn't have a VCR player at the time. So people, you know, this is awfully convenient to a lot of people that they happened to miss such, you know, compelling evidence that took them so long to work out the case. And even Mark Dutroux escaped from the police van while being transferred from court. He took one of the officers' guns. They had 5,000 people out looking, 5,000 police officers out looking for him, and it was only a forest ranger who found him because Mark Dutro had managed to get his car bogged in on a forest road.
Oh, my God. Jeez. Yeah, that's another one of the horrifying cases. Unfortunately, we started out with some of the more... they're all horrifying, I guess. Like I was trying to see if there was a silver lining case coming up, but really there aren't. They're all pretty bad, but... We've kind of started out with the more salacious ones. Another interesting case that really stood out to me, especially because I went to school up there at Syracuse. This happened in Syracuse, New York, around the time when I was in Syracuse, scary as it sounds. And this is John Jamelsk. And what he's doing is he's preying on these, again, transient-type folks and kidnapping women and holding them captive for various lengths of time. What was really interesting and really unique about this case, I thought, was that he would kidnap these girls, and like I said, keep them for various lengths of time, but then let them go. Just let them go. And this happened over and over and over again. And at certain times, a couple of them, or at least one of them, spoke out, went to the police, tried to alert folks to what this guy was up to, and it never went anywhere until finally he ends up getting caught and charged for all this stuff. But it's amazing that he just keeps doing this over and over again, kidnapping these girls, keeping them for a while, letting them go. And it's just stunning because it speaks to almost in a way the – we talked about the control aspect of all this. And it's like he didn't seem to have that hang up in a way. I would be too guilt-ridden, like you talked about earlier with the Colleen Stan case. The guy brings her – to see her parents, then afterwards he's like, oh, maybe I let on too much. This guy has the opposite feeling. He's just letting them go willy-nilly with no seem to concern for what might become of them going back into society. So what do you think was going on there?
Yeah, John Jamelsky, he was a hoarder, so collecting humans was sort of his, you know, his trophy piece of all his hoarding. He had 13,000 beer bottles and all other type of rubbish around the yard. He'd go around picking things up off the road and through scrap heaps and lived in, you know, a pretty unpleasant-looking house, but not knowing... From the outside, you wouldn't realise it was actually worth several million dollars.
Oh, wow.
And he built his dungeon, and he just hired contractors and just brought them in and said, you know, build me a dungeon. I want somewhere to store my things. But they didn't realise that the things that he was storing were humans. And one interesting thing about Jamelsky is that he collected 5 women, and they were all from different races, Native American, Latino, Vietnamese lady, and Caucasian, and a young African American girl. So, and each one of these he actually considered to be his friend. And so that's how he lived his life with them for a little while until he did release them. And he would often just drop them off at home. And then he'd, you know, over the next couple of months would drive past. And they did start getting reported to the police. The first 2 young girls didn't report him to the police. But then when the women did report him to the police, they were told, oh, that type of thing doesn't happen around here. And they were just ignored. And so the whole cycle would start again. He'd go cruising the streets and he'd bring home another young lady until one managed to escape and he was tracked down.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Refresh my memory. How long generally would he keep these girls before he let them go?
It all depends. He kept one lady for about 3 years. The first victim he kept for 2 years. Another woman he kept only for 4 months. With his final victim, he really thought they were having a relationship. And I think she was 16 at the time. And she would, you know, she would really put on the friendship element and was quite cunning in the way to, you know, wanting to go out and be his friend and go out of the bunker and do things. And that's how they got found out. He'd take her to karaoke and take her shopping. that he thought that actually thought she was in a relationship, and she knew that if she waited long enough, she'd find a way out.
Yeah.
And she did. She said she was calling and wanted to know some church times. So she called up her sister and told her what was happening, where they were at, and then the police were alerted.
Crazy, crazy stuff. Remarkable. Kind of goes back to the Philadelphia story, too, in a way. Like I said, these are happening in major cities that people manage to get away with it. It's scary.
So, yeah, it's like, you know, your next-door neighbor. That's the fear, is the next-door neighbor could be doing something, and you have no idea. And most people, when you see them on television interviews, have no idea that, that what was going on in the street. It's always, you know, they were such a quiet person, or they would have seemed normal, a bit unusual, but we didn't think that bad.
Right.
So.
Spooky. Keep an eye on your neighbor, folks. and speaking of sort of getting away with things, this next case, dude, this is going to be an inside joke, David, but this is kind of a shout out to my friend Lobo, because we had a long argument about life sentences in Sweden, and this kind of has, in a way, something to do with that, because it's the case of Annapurna Sahu, who was kept in captivity a stunning 25 years by her family in India. And then when she was released or freed, there was no charges filed, because they thought, the officials, I guess, kind of wrote it off, that the family was doing a good thing, because that's sort of the way the culture is over there. And even if they had been charged, the punishments would have been minimal at best. A stunning lack of accountability for a 25-year captivity. I guess enlighten me a little bit more to sort of how all that went down, in the sense that these folks, the family who kept Annapurna Sahu essentially trapped on their property for 25 years, you know,
yeah,
managed to not even get punished.
Like an outhouse in the backyard. And they put her there because, you know, often in some parts of India, women don't have a great deal of rights. And when she denied an arranged marriage, that was a day that the family decided that she was insane. And they went to doctors to try and get it proved that she was insane. And they went to witch doctors, and they couldn't get the outcome they wanted. So when they didn't get that, they then locked her in the outhouse. So that would have been about 1980 they locked her in the outhouse. And she wasn't released until 2005. And some people obviously knew about it, because it was a neighbour who went to the police and alerted them. But the Sahu family were also incredibly wealthy owners of a flour mill in India. So they weren't punished at all. They were really quite high up in the area. The punishment for keeping her held captive for 25 years would have only been 1 month in prison, because that's the Indian Penal Code states under 341 that punishment for wrongful restraints, whoever wrongly restrains a person shall be punished with a simple imprisonment for a term of which may be extended to 1 month. The police decided not to press charges.
That's insane.
And the police actually said, well, what else do you want us to do? Because if it wasn't for them locking her up, she could have run away, she could have been raped, she could have been murdered, her life could have been much worse. So, yeah, it's quite sad, particularly fate of, often hear cases of many women in different countries who are just terribly abused just through normal society. Society seems to just overlook their abuse and you know, takes it as a given. It's kind of harder for us to imagine. So we hear, cases in Africa where, 200 girls go missing.
Right, exactly. I don't even want to, I have to ask, I guess. I don't even want to go there, but I have to ask. If, let's say a real twisted individual was like listening to this, and they're like, well, forget it, man, I'm going to India. Like, if someone just went over and did that, let's say, you know, a Gary Heidnik or a Mark Dutroux learns of this information, of this stunning lack of accountability over in India for this stuff. Could some maniac like that go over to India and just do this, and they would end up just serving a month in prison if they were caught?
Yeah, I don't know what if they've made reforms to the law or what international law would dictate, depending on where they've come from. I imagine they'd probably see it quite different from foreigners.
That's true, yeah.
These people had quite high social standing, so they'd be the elite members of the society, and they were upset with the police officers for making the arrest but still praising them at the same time, so because of the shame that's brought the family. I don't know. I'd hope that people, anyone who is caught doing such a crime would be punished. So, I mean, I know there's a number of international laws.
Yeah, that's true.
For different types of crime, if you commit them while on holidays, still held responsible for them. So, I don't know. It hasn't been done, and hopefully it isn't done either. So.
Right. Yeah. So if there's any Gary Heidnik type listening right now in like Cleveland or something that wants to go and do this, it's not a good idea because that's true. If some American dude was caught doing it, they'd probably string him up in the street. So
yeah, I haven't heard of anyone traveling a long distance to do it to hold someone captive. It tends to be more around their their own lifestyle, or their social network, or they're part of the world. It's the people who they're held captive are sort of brought into their world.
Exactly. And, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So they that's where their base is. I'm sure people, tourists, often do commit crimes in real while overseas. So how long you can stay overseas for? I don't know.
Yeah. Now. You alluded to this case earlier, and I thought this was interesting because it stood out to me. This Tanya Koch, it's a lot like, well, it's a little less cut and dry than the Natasha Ryan case. But the Natasha Ryan case, it was a woman who essentially kind of went off the grid in Australia, and then a dude was accused of killing her, but it turns out she had just kind of gone off the grid and become more or less... agoraphobic almost, where she didn't even want to leave the house or anything. She kind of trapped herself in. But this Tanya Koch story is interesting. It's an American story. It really sounds more like a Lolita situation, but then after it all came out, it feels like she was kind of trying to save face in a way by saying that she was a kidnapped victim or a captive. So I'm trying to make, it's a very murky. I guess talk about the murky nature of the Tanya Koch case.
Well, yeah, the thing that when Tanya Koch was allegedly kidnapped, she ran away to Paul Hose's house. He was 33 at the time, I believe, and stayed there for 10 years. But she was sort of a girl that was going off the rails. The parents had had enough, and she was about to be put into state care. The parents didn't want her to live with her anymore. So it seems like she sort of, wanted to pretend she's a bit more mature than she was and started a relationship with someone who was, preying on her and who worked at the school. So that's what he got charged for, having a relationship with an underage girl. And that's what went to court.
Right.
The charges of being held captive or kidnapping were never brought to court. But then afterwards, to the media and to other places, media and book sales, and that's what she would present, is that she was held captive that time. But there was doubt all through the town of McKeesport, and that this isn't what occurred, that she could have left at any time, and that she chose to stay. So, obviously, you have to make of it what you will. It does seem like a girl that had a relationship with an older fellow, and then it falls apart. Just a very complex story.
Right. It's very interesting. To add more fuel to the weirdness of it. I believe it's her father. It may have been a stepfather, but I know it was a father figure. at one point said, you know, kind of wrote off the whole idea that she was held captive and said he wanted to hear this guy's side of the story and said, you know, oh, she was a young woman and that's kind of what they do, folks, or something like that.
Yeah, he said that he was suspicious about how it all went down as well. It sort of would cause a, you know, the end of their relationship. It doesn't seem like they ever repaired their relationship after that, after he made that comment. Paul Hose, who's still in prison, said that he would like to write his own book, and I believe there's talk about his son was talking about writing a book as well. That this, the son was sleeping in the room of the house while Tanya Cash was there, and the house is an old wooden rust belt home, and these are some noisy places. Any walking around, they would have been able to hear it throughout the house.
Yeah.
So to have it that no one knew she was up there, and then she had the internet, she had a cell phone, she had she could go out. Towards the end, she could go out, and she was eventually introduced to the parents, and then brought into the house and said, "This is my partner. She's coming to live with us."
Right.
And so she was, when she came out of captivity, she had bleached blonde hair, manicured nails, wearing nice clothes, starkly different to how any other captives have come out of their captivity.
Yeah, it's interesting too. She also, at one point, I think kind of what led to a lot of the unraveling of this, I believe, she was bragging to somebody and said, "If you look on the missing children website, you'll see my picture," or something like that. It wasn't like, "Oh, help me."
Yeah.
It was like, "Aren't I cool? I'm a missing child." It was really weird.
Yeah, and there was also in the book that she wrote, she was the milk carton kid, and she was on 400 million milk cartons. And I couldn't find any evidence that it actually occurred. But doesn't seem to be any milk cartons in existence out of the 400 million. So that was an interesting point. So you think it's quite convoluted. You have to, it sounds like mistakes were made by everyone in that case, of everyone involved. And, of course, predators who work with children obviously need to be watched. And for people who are vulnerable and who have no other opportunity, and he sounds like he became her safe haven.
Yeah.
After the police got here, see, the girl Amanda told the police, "I ain't just the only ones. It's some more girls up in that house." So they went up there, 30, 40 deep, and when they came out, was just astonishing, because I thought they were going to come up with nothing, because we see this dude every day. Right. I barbecue with this dude. We eat ribs and whatnot and listen to salsa music. You see where I'm coming from?
Yeah. And you had no indication that there was anything going on?
Bro, not a clue that girl was in that house or anybody else was in there against their will.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Because how he is, he just comes out to his backyard, plays with the dogs, tinker with his cars and motorcycles, goes back in the house. So he's somebody that you look and you look away because he's not doing nothing but the average stuff. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
There's nothing exciting about him. Well, until the day.